Hey everyone out there, and thanks again for joining us here at ASAP Nowcast, the podcast for ASAP Now. 2025 is throttling towards the end, and it is, as always, crazy how time flies. We will save an end of year recap for next month, and this month, I'd like us to be looking ahead to 2026. Because for anyone on the practice side of emergency medicine, that is not the clinical practice, but the how to run of practice side, November brings us a major release every year, which is CMS's final physician fee schedule for the upcoming year. This is the fee schedule that tells us how we'll be reimbursed, what our RVUs look like for our most common CPT. So it's very much important to us on what emergency medicine looks like from a financial model. As a reminder, as a process, CMS releases the proposed rule in the summer, then they open for comments and then publish the final rule right around now every year. And ASAP is extremely involved in making sure that what is good for the House of Emergency Medicine is heard and advocated for. So we have with us this month a friend to ASAP Now, Dr. Michael Granofsky, who is not only one of our columnists, but also an expert on all things reimbursement, as he also leads the ASAP Reimbursement Conference, joining us to chat about all things physician fee schedule for 2026. So come check it out. Hey everyone, and thanks again for joining us. Today we have with us a friend of ASAP Now and also the president of Logix Health, Dr. Mike Granofsky, to chat with us about the new and final Medicare physician fee schedule for 2026. So Mike, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Amy. Pleasure to be here. I know we've had these discussions a couple of times, and it's really nice to be back with you again.
Yeah, and it's awesome to frame what's coming for us for the next year for all people involved with kind of the practice side, the non-clinical practice side of emergency medicine. So I think let's just jump right in. Like, the headlines recently have been all about the government shutdown. Like, thank God, it seems like we're not shut down anymore. But did that have any impact on the physician final rule this year?
Yeah, great issue. And I live in downtown Washington, D.C., and I can tell you that it had a big impact here. The Uber drivers had nobody to take. Restaurants were empty. I could finally get a reservation at some trendy spot that I would otherwise never get into in Georgetown. On the regulatory front, a couple of things were delayed and some things were on time. The rule that we're talking about, the Medicare Physician Fee Schedule Final Rule, that actually came out on time right in the beginning of November. But some of the rules have been delayed. So the outpatient equivalent to this rule that determines how our hospital partners are paid under the outpatient prospective payment system, that rule's not even out yet. And then we have a little bit of an issue of some items that are now being handled outside of the traditional one-year cadence of federal rulemaking. And those have to do with continuing resolution items. And there are two in particular that fall now outside of the rule, and they were impacted by the government shutdown. One, the telehealth waivers that we all relied upon during the pandemic that allowed the patient to be located not necessarily in a rural area. The technical term is a health professional shortage area, and not necessarily in an approved location like a hospital or a physician's office. Those waivers expired, and we had a lot of consternation in the regulatory and the billing space because there was a total lack of clarity about whether we could bill for telehealth during this time that the government was shut down. But we just had a continuing resolution issued, and the telehealth waivers are back, and it's business as usual. But as has happened frequently in the past, that little continuing resolution only goes until the last day of January. Who knows? Maybe we'll be talking again in the spring.
Yeah, it seems like in a lot of these instances, it's kind of kick the can down the road and see what happens. So I'm sure we will certainly chat again. But let's go ahead and just jump right into what they did release. So what's going with ED? Like, you know, how's the RVUs changing? Obviously, there's the different components, work, practice expense, and liability. But yeah, let's chat.
So the work RVUs make up about 80% of our RVUs, and they are not changing. We have a very, very strong team that represents emergency medicine through ASAP. ASAP actually has the only recognized seats for emergency medicine on the Relative Value Update Committee. And our work RVUs for our key codes, that level 3, level 4, level 5, they've remained stable. 2024, 2025, 2026. As an example, 99284, it's been 2.74 work RVUs for the last 3 years. 99285, it's been 4.00 RVUs for the last several years. So that's the good news. Nice, stable, and hard work being done by our volunteers who are on the road 15 to 20 days a year defending the switch and making sure that things go well-minded for the future of emergency medicine and the safety net. Now, the practice expense has had a complicated process, and it's probably more than we can get fully into during a podcast-type format discussion, but the practice expense for some of our services, they're going down. For procedures, the practice expense is going down a little bit. And for hospital medicine services, critical care services, and observation. And it's going down just a little bit for those really key ED services, 99283, 84, and 85. The liability insurance, which makes up the smallest component of our RVUs, that's going up a little bit. So on the whole, I would say our RVUs are down very slightly going from 2025 to 2026.
Yeah, and so give me a little bit of color here, Mike. When you think about RVUs and how they're broken down between work, practice expense, and liability, and some go up and some go down, like how I think of these is commonly just total RVU. Like that's always how I think about it. That's how my practice happens to think about it. Could you just give me a little color for our audience of, you know, when we read about RVU, sometimes it literally just says RVU. Like, how should we interpret that? Should we assume that that is work? Should we assume that that is total? Or what's the commonalities? I just want to get on the same vernacular.
Thank you so much for bringing that up. And there is certainly an alphabet soup here. I think many institutions and groups pay their employees or partners based on work RVUs. But when a bill goes to Medicare, Medicaid, Aetna, Cigna, United Healthcare, the entity, the tax ID number, is paid in terms of total RVUs. And so in emergency medicine, as we go from 2025 to 2026, if your employer has a small decrease in total RVUs, even if the work RVUs didn't change, that pain gets felt somewhere down the line.
That's really helpful. So I think for our audience, if you get interested in this topic and you want to understand how it applies to you, be sure to either check your contract or talk to your team about, is RVU total RVU or work RVU? I think it's worth deep diving a little bit, though, since work RVUs are staying the same. Like, what's up with practice expense going down? It feels like, if anything, the practice of emergency medicine is getting harder and there's more burden. Like, why is that component on the downslope?
We are the unintended victims of a major change that's taking place. Over the last 10, 12, 15 years, we've had an evolution of physicians that where they used to have a shingle out, have a solo practice. Now those have been consolidated into group practices, and many of the group practices have been purchased by hospitals, and hospitals have been aggregated into health systems. So lots of physicians who years ago used to maintain their own separate office, but also see patients in the hospital, either as the admitting physician or on a consultative basis, they generally do not have office expenses anymore. If you're a general surgeon or a cardiologist directly employed by the hospital, your professional fees probably don't need to reflect as high a practice expense as was in play when you had your own separate office. And CMS has decided to significantly decrease the practice expense to services that are delivered in a hospital as opposed to in an office. And there was an old methodology, an old algorithm that maintained a whole bunch of practice expense costs like rent and lights and snow removal and things like that, that frankly aren't attributable to hospital-based physicians, whether they're general surgeons, OBs, intensivists, and that's what's driving the practice expense down. That's maybe not truly recognized anymore, not truly appropriate anymore, practice expense for running an office. It's being removed from the formula when the service is delivered in a hospital.
Ah, interesting. So it's something a little bit unique to how emergency medicine is as physician groups contracted with hospitals then.
That's right.
Okay. So I think you've walked me through the components of the RVU. So overall for 2026, what's your outlook for whether RVUs will have a decrease or increase in terms of total? And then, you know, of course, how does that translate into reimbursement?
So the overall RVUs are going down slightly. And though the practice expense went down meaningfully, I think I mentioned liability insurance is going up a little bit. And I'll take our two really key codes, 99284. So we're going from 3.60 down to 3.54. So a very small decrease, 0.06 RVUs. 99285 going from 5.22 down to 5.13, so 0.09 RVUs. But the good news is in the conversion factor, which is more than making up for it.
Awesome. So for once, we're getting a little bit of an increase there and actually going up in reimbursement then, correct?
That's right. We have, for the first time in 5 years, an increase in the Medicare payment per RVU, what's called the conversion factor. And there's another unique thing, which is we have two different conversion factors this year. Most ED docs are not in advanced alternative payment models. That's a very sophisticated and quality reporting process that requires lots and lots of infrastructure. It would be typically associated with an employed, highly integrated group. And the vast majority of us are not in advanced alternative payment models. So I'll stick to that branch of the conversion factor discussion. We finished 2025 with a published conversion factor of $32.3465. And I'll go through the three increases that we got. You get 25 basis points or 0.25% based on a regulatory update that's in place for the next couple of years. We got about 0.5% based on what's called budget neutrality. And that is the budgetary slack that was created by decreasing the practice expense and some of the procedure work RVUs. So that accrued to the conversion factor, which then applies to all of our services. And then in July, when OBBA, or the One Beautiful Bill Act, was passed, there was a 2.5% increase to the conversion factor for 1 year. So we're going up 3.26%, and the typical ED doc will have a conversion factor of 33.4009. And if we look to translate that into real money for our codes, that level four visit, it's going from $116, it's going up $5 to $121. And that level five visit is going from $168, it's going up $7-$8 to $176. So on the whole, I think though practices will see decreases some places, overall, taking all of our services together, I think we'll be about plus 1%.
All right. That's fantastic news. I mean, we don't get good news a lot, I feel like, when we talk about physician fee schedule. So I'll certainly take it. So what else? What's the other big news in the role? Obviously, conversion factor is huge. Your walk through the RVU has been extremely helpful, too. What else do you think is worth mentioning for our emergency medicine physician partners?
So the telehealth regulations, I socialized a little bit at the beginning of our discussion. And we have all the waivers in place now as of today to continue to deliver telehealth just like we did during the pandemic. Our codes are approved. The 9928X codes are approved. We don't have to have the patient weirdly located in a hospital setting. They can be in their home, and they don't have to be in a very restrictive health professional shortage area. So that's great news. And then MIPS. Congress took a fairly soft view and I think was a little bit kind. The thought was at one point that the number of MIPS points required to avoid a penalty could go up to 82 or 85 points. In fact, that was published in a prior proposed rule, and they are only requiring 75 points to avoid a penalty going forward. So the estimate is that 84% of reporting physicians will meet the reporting requirements. Now, the downside to that is if only 16% of physicians don't fully meet the reporting requirements, there aren't that many penalties, and it's a budget neutral program. So any bonuses really come out of the penalties that are generated. So if we have 84% or 8.5 out of 10 physicians splitting the penalty money that's derived from 1.5 out of 10 physicians, the bonus is probably going to be very, very small for 2026. And historically, they've only been about 1% anyway.
Yeah, and I'd love to elaborate on that, because I think telehealth, you know, I mean, I may be biased because I don't work in rural areas, but telehealth seems to be a small volume in terms of our patients for emergency medicine. But MIPS to me is something that is touching a lot of ER doctors. Like, I mean, I see documentation all the time just there to hit MIPS measures. Like, obviously, there's a lot of work in registries. Like, Mike, you and I work in our day jobs talking about MIPS quite a bit, too. It feels like this is a government program that they keep talking about, kind of taking what you call a soft line with it. Like, I'm with you. Like, it just feels like your overall potential increase is maxing at like 1%, but there's a significant amount of work for the ED docs and documentation for, of course, rev cycle companies and coding. There's registry fees, all for just a 1% increase. Like, is the government making any stand really on MIPS? It almost felt like to me about a year ago that they might even get rid of the program. But I don't know if you have any conjecture here or just color, since I know a lot of ER doctors are touched frequently by having to document certain things for MIPS.
Similar to you, I thought a year ago that when we were seeing big swaths of government, you know, sort of moved out of the budget, that maybe MIPS would follow suit. And I think we would all probably cheer that process. It's a very tough program. It doesn't feel like it moves quality as much as the effort that goes into it. We are all very interested in the journey to quality. It just doesn't seem like this program that had us giving Cipro and beta blockers and blood cultures, that it's really getting us where we want to be. In fact, a lot of groups that we work with have their own separate quality programs outside of MIPS because they're driving clinically meaningful measures. Now, ACIP does have its own quality clinical data registry, and that has empowered us as a specialty to come up with clinically relevant measures, and that's been a fabulous win. Separately, CMS is moving towards what's called MIPS Value Pathways, which is a slightly downscale program and won't have quite the administrative burden. But like you, I still think that there's probably a better answer out there on the journey to quality.
Yeah. And I love, you know, just touching base with you about this, because I feel like you're such a wealth of knowledge on what's coming. And you got all experience, you know, of course, in what you do with Logix Health. So, Mike, I want to say thank you again for coming on, chatting with us about the new physician fee schedule. Sounds like not bad news. And honestly, that's both a surprise and great news, I think, for emergency medicine.
You got it, Amy. Pleasure as always. And it's a complicated rule with over 2,300 pages. Everybody does the best they can to digest the information quickly and get it out to those who are making budgetary decisions for the next calendar year. And some of it is even still sinking in. Look forward to talking again in the spring.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Mike. I know there are a lot of emergency physicians that want nothing to do with how the finances of emergency medicine work and just want to show up and just clinically take care of patients. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. But I do think it's nice to have a little bit of education about what makes the system and the infrastructure go round, because sometimes we do see how that comes into our day-to-day practice. Maybe not so much with what we do for patients, but certainly from a documentation perspective, for example, MIPS, which Dr. Ranofsky and I were just chatting about. I personally find all things RevCycle extremely fascinating and revealing on how healthcare operates. Everything from how our clinical work at the bedside is translated into CPTs, which the AMA owns, and then negotiated into RVU values, which the RUC owns, which is the AMA committee called the Specialty Society Relative Value Scale Update Committee, which goes in a room and negotiates what the RVUs are for various CPTs across the different specialties, represented by all the different specialties. And then that RVU value is then negotiated into a dollar amount set as a baseline by Medicare in this physician fee schedule we just discussed annually. And then that actually gets negotiated into actual dollar amounts by payers as a percent of Medicare, i.e. a payer may pay 100% of Medicare. So exactly what Medicare does. They might pay a little bit under, they might pay 200% of Medicare. All that is done to translate the work at the bedside into a dollar amount, and then may or may not impact how the doctor is paid based on various payroll models. So I find the whole thing really interesting on how different incentives and different organizations get layered into healthcare as a model for the country, and where, of course, incentives can conflict and we run into issues. So again, if you hate this, no problem. I'm not saying you have to be committed, but it is really interesting sometimes to learn more. If you are so inclined, ASEP offers a lot of resources. You may check out asep.org/RC. And that is the link for the reimbursement conference, which Dr. Gronowski actually leads. The upcoming one is called ASEP Accelerate. That is January 20 through 21 of next year in San Diego. And all things money also tie to advocacy. So I'd be remiss without plugging the other ASEP conference, LAC, which you can learn more about at asep.org/LAC. And that's Leadership and Advocacy, which is held in April this year. It's going to be 26 to 28 in DC for 2026. So that is it for us this month. We are digital this month, so all your favorites can be found on the website at asepnow.com. There is, of course, lots of content, including a clinical pearl from the Critical Care Corner on why the non-rebreather should be abandoned. This is brought to you by Dr. Paul Janssen. We have a very interesting piece on the first National Congress on Emergency Medical Care happening in the Ukraine, and an also very interesting take in an opinion piece on why physicians have to help reduce plastic waste. Of course, there is tons more, so check it out on the site, along with all of our prior resources, columns, and of course, podcasts. As always, tweet us if you have an idea at ASEP Nation, or feel free to tweet me direct at Amy Faith Ho. We would love to hear your thoughts and feedback and keep you tuning in. So thanks, everyone, and we will see you all next month.